Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest, Andrew Slater, the former CEO of Capitol Records, is helping to put the spotlight on a specific time and place in American pop music, the Laurel Canyon scene of the late 1960s. His new film, featuring Jacob Dylan, is called Echo in the Canyon, and it focuses on the influence of groups like the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, the Beach Boys, and Buffalo Springfield, to name a few. The film and a new album of the same name feature some of today's biggest stars covering the 60s defining songs. Andrew Slater will be in town to discuss the movie at the Berkshire International Film Festival on June 2nd at 1 at the Mehewi in Great Barrington.
Everyone was writing together. You'd go over to someone's house and you always brought your guitar.
People would just knock on the door and go, hey, listen to this.
Brian lived right down the street from us. The whole living room was full of sand. She said, I know it's crazy, but he's writing some great songs.
Andrew Slater, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you.
What got you thinking about this particular time and place in the first place?
Actually, the idea of bands trading ideas and being influenced by each other was not foreign to me. As a rock critic in the late 70s and early 80s, we all knew the influence that the Beach Boys and the Beatles had on each other. But for me and for Jacob, we had reached a point in our lives where we were trying to figure out what we were going to do next. And, you know, sometimes you have to look backwards to see where you want to go, where you've come from to where you want to go. And we were watching this film, which was a film called Model Shop, shot in the late 60s by Jacques Demy, a French filmmaker. And it showed us Los Angeles at a time of innocence, you know, in really before, you know, before the onset of psychedelia and the age of the singer-songwriter. And so we went back to that time to try to look at some songs to see if we could, you know, see we could work on. And so we set out to make a record, really. And the songs led us to the stories behind the songs and the people who wrote them. And we started to do research, and I just didn't feel like it should be left to research. And I thought we should go talk to people and figure out how to make this something bigger than just a collection of songs.
One thing I really liked in your film is the way there's a cross-cutting between that film Model Shop and Jacob Dylan going through the LA of today. When you were figuring out which songs to do and which artists to interview and revisit, how did you gather that roster?
Well, it's really, you know, our film that deals with Laurel Canyon is really in, you know, some sense about the first period of Laurel Canyon, because we think there's three. There's the period where the band see A Hard Day's Night, and they see the dream that the Beatles are living, four guys traveling around, having fun. And they come to Los Angeles after the Byrds have a hit, and they chase that dream. And that's when the Mamas and Papas and the Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds all move into Laurel Canyon. The next period is really the psychedelic period. And I think, you know, things get askew, they get darker. And then after that, there's a retrenchment to, you know, sort of American roots music and country influences in the rock. And that is the period where, you know, it's a search for the individual, and the singer-songwriter period sort of starts. I mean, we were really interested just in that first period. And the songs in the film really are the ones that kind of have defining moments for the band. We, you know, explore Go Where You Want to Go by the Mamas and Papas, their first single in 1965. You gotta go where you want to go, do what you want to do, with whoever you want to do. Go where you want to go, do what you want to do, with whoever you want to do. And that song is written from the perspective of John to Michelle, which we later find out. and because I think he thought the nature of the relationship that they were having was different than what she thought. But the same sort of holds true for you know, Going Back, which is a song that more or less is the last straw for David Crosby's relationship with Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman. And so that sort of breaks up the birds. And then Expecting to Fly really frames the film. Because for me, that song represents a sort of end of the innocence. It's the end of a relationship. And I thought we could use it as the end of that period of innocence in, you know, 67. For the Springfield, Neil Young's, Stephen Stills says that was sort of a warning sign for him that Neil was going to go on his own. And so when it frames the film, it you know, suggests the innocence in the beginning, and ultimately in the end, it suggests, you know, one of the members of the band going off and doing their own thing.
For people who follow Neil Young, it's sort of what he's famous for, going his own way. But I was curious about his role in the movie because he's playing guitar over the end credits, but he's one of the only ones from this era who's not interviewed.
Well, you know, without giving too much of the film away, I think the movie frames a specific period, and in a sense, he represents an artist forging his own path in the end. You know, in 66, it's called The Buffalo Springfield. In 69, it's called Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And I think since we really don't deal with that period, you know, using him as a metaphor in the end, playing a psychedelic solo, forging his own path, you know, sort of lets you see that one era is over and another era begins.
How did, in your mind, the Laurel Canyon era come to an end? Was it commercialism that happened?
Well, the end of the Laurel Canyon era is something for someone else to explore. For us, we were just trying to explore the period before it became big business, before the ego started to take over for, you know, people having success. And, you know, the sense of community was there, so that the film to me is as much about the echo as it is about the canyon. It's about the echo of people's ideas going between each other in a band, because all these bands had multiple singers and multiple songwriters, much like the Beatles. And then the echo of their creativity sort of going between house to house at a time when the sense of community and kindness was still, you know, very much alive. And then that echo going across to England and changing the course of the Beatles. And somewhat in the film, you have it, you know, echoing across time, where you can see the younger artists, Beck and Fiona Apple and Cat Power and Regina, whose own work sort of reflects that influence in different ways in that.
Tell me about the concert that's part of the film with the artists you just mentioned. I guess they were marking an anniversary, and you said that, hey, no one else was going to do this, so let's put a band together and see what happens.
Well, when we saw Model Shop and we started to explore the songs, it coincided with the 50th anniversary of the Byrds' first album. And so in getting people to come to collaborate with us, we had this sort of anniversary, and then we did the concert. I mean, you know, you have to remember that there's so many documentaries of music documentaries that are in the marketplace now. And for me, to make one, I wanted to recreate in some ways the feeling I had when I sat, you know, in a movie theater in the early 70s watching Woodstock and Monterey Pop and, oh, Hard Day's Night and Help and Don't Look Back. And because I wasn't allowed to go to concert halls when I was a kid because I was young and I wanted to see this music in the late 60s and early 70s. So my DNA was forever changed in the cinema. So to make something that was a little broader, I wanted to try and take you into a recording studio in a song, and then in the middle of that song, take you to the concert stage, and then come back to the recording studio, and then have the song being played in front of the author of the song. And so the concert was really used as a vehicle, you know, to sort of make the film, as opposed to recognize and celebrate anything. It was really a shooting day.
A lot of the stars of the film came out for the premiere. We're speaking just after you premiered the movie in L.A. What was that like?
Well, I think the most incredible thing about the premiere is that the movie played at the Cinerama Dome. You know, if you're a kid and you love movies, as I did and do, and you love going to the movies, you want to go to the Los Angeles, you know, Cinerama Dome, which has been in L.A. since 1963 when It's a Mad, 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 Mad World opened there. And if you're a filmmaker, you aspire to have your movie shown in the Cinerama Dome. And so it was very, you know, humbling and at the same time rewarding to see all the work that we'd done to bring this film to life on that incredible screen in that incredible room.
How conscious of the ticking clock were you when making this project? The reason I ask is a lot of the people who made this music, which still kind of looms over our culture, are gone. And the ones who are here certainly aren't getting any younger. So there's a certain nostalgia that builds into the film as well.
I just love the songs that these songwriters and artists wrote and played and are so much a part of my own history and what brought me to California. You know, that I grew up in New York, I played in a concrete park, and I thought in the mid-60s, late-60s, that maybe there was something better than my, you know, life there, and I thought of California as this idyllic place at the edge of the country, and, you know, from what I saw in films, and so in shooting these people, I wasn't concerned about anything other than shooting them in a way that they looked good, and that, because I also wanted to show the human aspects of it. I just didn't want the voice to be telling a story over footage. I wanted you to see their expressions. As a journalist, I was never able to really describe in words, you know, what I was seeing from a person. That's probably why I, you know, left journalism, because it wasn't that good. But in the film, I wanted them to look good, and I wanted to stay on their faces when they were telling you a story so you could really see the person in there.
Andrew Slater will be in town to discuss Echo in the Canyon at the Berkshire International Film Festival on June 2nd at 1 at the Mehewi in Great Barrington. Andrew Slater, safe travels east.
Thank you. See you soon.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.